Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
Oil and energy is the lifeblood of our economy. We have to transport things. We have to get there. And we're not in a situation where the average person can rely on their own garden at this point. We just can't.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and I'm back with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hi, Paul. It seems like a year since we talked last.
Oh, my goodness. It feels like, what is it they say, decades happen in weeks? It feels like a decade since last week.
It does. It does. So much has happened. So this is what we're going to talk about today. Wow, the S&P 500 hit an all-time new high just today as we're recording this. An all-time new high, not just recovered some of its post-onset of war market losses. We have really low inflation as compared to what was expected, and other oddities, because it's an odd thing that we have to talk about there with that low inflation. That's what I have on my plate. Anything else on your plate today?
No, just kind of try to talk people through what we know and what we don't know. I will say the magnitude of this move is something that I don't remember seeing so quickly and severely with the backdrop of known knowns, right?
Yeah, very interesting times. You can see the Dow hasn't quite made it back to the 50,000 mark, which Pam Bondi is famous for putting in our brains. But the NASDAQ very close to, these are all-time highs back here. S&P back over 7,000 on the futures, 7,002, I think, on the probably on the cash market. But look at this powerful rebound, and that's intense. That is X number of straight days of green candles. It's a very unusual thing, Paul. So unusual, in fact, that when you categorize it and you look at those last 10 days of returns, Warren Pies put up this awesome chart here from 314 Research. It says, quote, the last 10 days have been unlike any 10-day period in the market since 1950. First, the S&P 500 is up 9.8%, nearly 10% in 10 days, which is the 99.7th percentile of all 10-day returns in all of history for the U.S. stock market.
Well, my instincts were correct because I was like, I tried to look back through the charts as far as I could, but I didn't go back that far. And I kept scratching my head going like, wow, this is absolutely amazing. Like, I don't ever remember seeing a move like this out of the 2009 bottom. So obviously, maybe the 2009 bottom initially. And even the tariff taco, you know, when Trump turned around last year, you didn't have that major of a move with him switching his stance like it did. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, you know what they say? Markets go up like this when there are more buyers than sellers. So there's an absolute wall of liquidity that's come into this market from somewhere. And we have to begin to speculate because I don't have any insights into that. I don't have the level of access that allows me to see where all this liquidity is coming from. But it's kind of weird because we know that China's been selling their treasuries, which would be the wrong kind of liquidity. That's a drain on liquidity. We know that the Middle East countries are probably also going to have to start selling their dollar-based assets because they have giant holes in their economies right now that they're going to have to plug somehow, probably from savings, which they save in treasuries and stocks in the U.S. So it's a real mystery where this is coming from. It's not coming from Europe. They got troubles of their own. It's very difficult, Paul, for me to begin to guess where a legitimate source for this much liquidity, given the state of the world right now.
Yeah, it is to me too. And look, insiders, there's some data out. The insiders, let's see, the data says that only one buy out of the top 60 insider transactions recently, and that was April, April 13th, 14th, the 8th from the 9th, basically a week, only one insider buy. So insiders are selling. So, you know, we do have lower volume. I do understand that there's some repositioning, like the algorithms. You know, and this kind of reminds me, if we go back to the doctors during COVID, right? I think we can say that without getting punished now. If we go back to that period of time, there were those who were aware that there were issues in the system, and they saved a lot of people. There were people that listened to you, and you were warning them, and it helped save a lot of people, right? But there were also some doctors that I got into some pretty interesting debates with locally that just trusted. They, you know, based on what they had experienced in their past, they trusted what was coming down from the top. Until they fully understand on the other side that all of a sudden what they thought was trustworthy was not trustworthy anymore. And some chose to stick their head in the sand, and some decided to walk a path less traveled, and some just did nothing, right? So the ones that I really respected were the ones like, hey, I got to start doing some more research on my own. I can't trust that source anymore. So that kind of reminds me, I bring that up from a market standpoint, right? If you're an intellectual, if you've been trained in finance and you're building these models, these algorithms, you have been told the market is all-knowing. There's been a period of time in the past where the market was all-knowing, right? Because we're smarter together than what we are individually. Together with price action that takes place, we can see things that the market can see things and put the pieces together collectively. So that's why it's important to watch money flow. That's where the basis of technical analysis came from. And yeah, you know, it's not perfect, but it does give you an advantage to understand breakouts and breakdowns and things of that nature. If, however, there's a hidden hand out there that is distorting the market, then that's a problem because you've got these algorithms that are going, hey, you know, yeah, I can look at the data and see that we've got a train wreck coming. Like, and you've done a phenomenal job. Your most recent alert that was out, just to kind of everybody go find it and listen into it. I think the title was Warning U.S. Petroleum Inventories Are Being Raided. It was phenomenal, Chris. But the market doesn't seem to be pricing that in or paying any attention to it. And I think a lot of it has to do with these algorithms are just assuming that the market knows something that we don't, right? And I'm trying to figure out, okay, based on this data, what's the market telling us that we don't see? And my question is, I can't come up with how we don't end up in a problem here. So my question is there a hidden hand that's forcing a lot of buying with these algorithms and institutions that are just fully trusting that the market knows all right now, but there's some hidden hand that's making it dishonest?
Well, I would agree with that because, again, this here says, wow, more buyers than sellers, okay? This says this is such a powerful move that it's within the top 99.7th percentile of all such similar moves in all of S&P history, which says that, okay, if the market is actively seeing something you and I aren't seeing right now, the only thing that can account for this right now, given the rest of the data we're about to go through, we're in pretty sorry shape, economically speaking, right now. Normally, stocks are saying this says major bull market coming, but there's another explanation, Paul. It's possible that the stock market is saying the Fed's going to have to print and print a lot of money, and this would fit with that, but I can't find solid fundamental economic data that I can sort of track through. Housing, sales, things like that. I'm at a loss on the typical fronts that you would analyze something like this in. Wow, the economy's about to do great. Or the Fed is about to print.
Yeah, but and we've seen moves into commodities, right? But from that standpoint, if the Fed's going to print that much money, okay, I would anticipate that you're going to see gold and silver hitting new highs. I would expect copper to be hitting new highs, which copper's had some pretty strong moves lately. And I would expect to be oil moving a lot higher, right? So even in that scenario, that does make sense to me, maybe the average person. But if you're an institution and they're going to print that much money, you want real things that can be utilized and should hold their value a lot easier than what stocks would. You know, go back to the 1970s and that major inflation, we were in a major commodities bull market during that period of time. And so that's the one thing that it has me scratching my head a little bit is I could see that if commodities were moving a little bit more. Maybe it's just, I don't know.
I've been on this soapbox for a long time saying, because, you know, I was an active day trader for a while. And so I was in and out of markets, and I had a couple of niches that I understood really well. And it worked really well from 2005 to 2007. Started breaking down. By 2008, I had to get out because something had changed fundamentally. And looking back, I now know that I was trading against humans, and then I was trading against computers, and I stood no chance, right? Because I could be watching something, and I would hit a sell button, but, you know, whole seconds would pass between my cognition and that sell, and they were operating on microsecond timescales. And it became... it became about the sport of it, which was had nothing to do with fundamentals, right? It had to do with what's the order book, what is it stacked like? If there's more people on this side of the boat than that side of the boat, great, we'll raid that side of the boat. And it was, just became this whole game, and there were lots and lots of very complex games. In the context of that, I also think it became more easier for if somebody wanted to. I could see how if you said, hey, Chris, I'll make you the Federal Reserve, I'll give you an infinite money printing press, and I want you to make the markets go up and to the right. I could do that. And I don't even have nearly as sophisticated a relationship with the markets as they do, but you understand how you could use things like the paper futures markets and options markets and the tick reading and slamming the VIX. There's all these complicated things you could do out there in the world of derivatives to have the tail wag the dog, because very high leverage products. And so
yes,
if I could do it, I bet they can. Yeah. I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed is leading up until 2007, 2008, one of the things that was very important, so you have support and resistance to explain this. So you'll trend sideways for a period of time, which is literally what we have done since about September in the S&P 500. Okay, so you trend sideways, and then you have a breakdown. Through all of the period of time prior to about 2014, that was your signal to exit. But then all of a sudden, you'd have a breakdown that lasts two or three days, and then you rip higher on the other side.
Yep.
And I always said, look, if I had the ability to design a computer trading algorithm, I would take advantage of the market by forcing the market to fill these triggers and then start buying on the other side. Market manipulation, but look, that's kind of what can be done. So it happens so commonly and started around 2014, we actually changed the rules of our strategy a little bit to give several days on those breakdowns before we executed, because of the fact that it would wash you out and then the market would take off. That's a lot different than what we had seen any time prior in history.
Well, I used to trade bottoms. I'd wait for something to bottom, and you see some sort of a price level come down, and then it would sort of bump along. But what you're talking about is, I think we just broke through a price, one of those support levels right here at the 6,500 mark, and then it just went exact. There's no bottom here. It immediately goes the other way. I call these now needle bottoms. They're not W bottoms. They're not U bottoms. They're not flat bottoms. This is all you get these days, and this has been true for about, I'd say, almost 10 years now. Mm-hmm. That's your bottom now.
Yeah.
Instantaneous other direction. Look at the Russell 2000. No basing, no digesting. It was red coming down into it, and then just boom, green the other way.
Mm-hmm.
9 out of 10 days, green as can be.
Yeah, and technically, I mean, we moved to defense. Now, we had already been out of the S&P and the NASDAQ, but the reality is, you know, except for some, you know, smaller one or two strategies that we had longer term. So anyway, you know, breakdown, you're below for a period of time, you get a long-term sell signal, and then all of a sudden on the other side, this happens. And you just have to be patient in these environments, right? You know, and that's the conversation that I want to have with people. And maybe I'm blind, maybe we're not seeing something. You've done a phenomenal job laying out the train wreck that looks like it's going to unfold, that I can't see how it doesn't happen, right? Unless we get demand destruction dramatically. So in this environment, when things don't add up, something's wrong. I've talked to several individuals that are long-term investors, that are tactical, you know, and I'm like, hey, what am I missing here, right? You know, something doesn't add up. And that's where you just want to look at your situation. If you're ahead, look, a little missed opportunity, if you're cautious right now, is going to hurt your feelings. But it's a different that if this is some false or manipulated move and it's trying to keep everybody happy here in the interim period until we hit this wall, or there's an event that causes them to blame it on something else, right? The catastrophic decline to the downside, if oil prices were to spike to $200, $250 a barrel, you can't get it and it shuts the economy down. Kind of like COVID, market was just rip-roaring higher. There's rumors of shutdowns. We're seeing all this stuff, and then it kind of ticks and crashes, right? Now, back then, they shut the economy down. You can print money and everything goes back. But if you know, even if they shut the economy down in the interim period and we have something like that, how long is it going to take to refill the hole that's in this that we're headed to right now, Chris? I don't think they can do it in 30 days, can they?
Oh, you can't print oil, as they say. And oil is the economy. So when you say demand destruction, I hear economic destruction because oil is the economy, right? The economy is lots of different episodes of work happening, right? So the economy is work. Work requires energy. Energy is what's missing in the story right now. So you follow that back. If you have the economy here and you're missing energy, you're going to have less economy. Now, you can't always predict where and when. Those are decisions that are made. Let's dive into that more in just a minute. Paul, when we come back, I want to talk about the incredible... Anybody who's looking at buying or selling a house, you got to watch what this next piece we're coming up with. So we'll be right back. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. Paul, let's turn now to the economy as it is. I've been tracking oil so much, I just did another tour through my financial Twitter sphere, and I found Nick Gearley just this morning talking about how the housing market, quote, is in a full-fledged depression. He's using the D word here. Existing sales in March hit their second lowest level ever for the month, behind only 2009. I think we all remember what that was about. Not only that, he says sales volumes are down 25% from pre-pandemic norms and continuing to drop year over year. Why is it happening? Simple. Sky-high prices. Even though values are starting to drop in many markets, he writes, overall price levels remain disconnected from what buyers can pay. So they're not buying. A concerning signal for the spring-summer housing market. Sellers better get ready to cut the price. And by the way, he's got a cool little app down there. He says to track sales for your city, you can download the Reventure and hit home sales surplus deficit on your mobile phone and find out how your area is doing. But here's the chart down here. I mean, look at this. We have to go back to the great housing crisis, or we have to go all the way back to 1996 when the country is like half the size it is right now, to find a similar sales statistic. That's not good. So housing, you know, back, Paul, when I said fundamentals don't matter, it used to be the consumer was 70% of the economy and government and industry was the other 30%. But you tracked that 70% to find out how you were doing. So that was principally auto sales or other durable goods. It was real estate and it was jobs, right? If you could just sort of get your head around those three things, you could roughly understand what was going to happen. But there's no sign of this anywhere in the stock market right now.
No, none at all. And look, there's a lot of real estate agents out there, and I don't think I saved it, but I saw a statistic, a shocking number of real estate agents didn't have a transaction last year. And that data confirms it, right? Well, those real estate agents need that income to come in. They spend that back into the economy. So that's another section of the economy that's been hit that we're just not seeing that unfold in the markets right now. And when you take that with all of the other weight of the evidence, it just doesn't make sense to see panic moves like this in the market unless we're just literally in the period of time where retail is creating the perfect environment for big institutions to be able to offload their shares. I mean, and now's a good time. Like, I made that statistic a minute ago, but it does make sense to show this picture because it's a really good picture. Look, so this was posted by No Limit. I found him not too long ago. I really like the work that he puts out. So insiders are still selling. Only one buyout of the top 60 insider transactions. It makes you wonder who's buying and providing them with exit liquidity.
A sea of red.
So if you look at that, if you look at that, I mean, it's just a sea of red, right? One buy right here, okay? And then I don't know what the black is. I didn't look at that severe, but that's just a good picture of another section of the economy where the insiders are the ones that are supposed to know that, you know, they're right at the source of information that's coming in, and they're not going to sell if they believe that the environment is really, really good. They're going to be buying. So if they think that, hey, the market's overreacting to everything right here, you know, I would see tons of insider buying along with this panic buying that's in, you know, in the market. So all we can do is just kind of look at the evidence around, and the evidence is just not adding up for moves like this in the market.
Well, no, it isn't. And here's another one of those fundamental things. We'll have to stop talking fundamentals because they clearly don't work anymore. But it used to be that if you looked at the Main Street, that's the University of Michigan Consumer Confidence Survey. So when people are confident, they tend to buy more homes, take more trips, buy cars, invest in things like that. And it's been absolutely since COVID, it's just been trending down. And this is one of the lowest readings on record right here. Consumers, again, so this is everybody in the country, are the least confident they've been in a long time. But Wall Street is partying like crazy. Now, a partial explanation for this, Paul, you and I talked about it a couple of times in the past, is that turns out half of all spending now comes from the top 10% who own 92% of all the stocks. So those are kind of correlated things. Like if our economy is becoming more dependent on wealthy people who are dependent on the stock market going up, you can start to feel the nested set of incentives in this program, right? So, gosh, you know, can't give money to everybody, but if we can drive stocks up, gives you good political narrative coverage. Hey, we must be doing a great job because stocks are cheering us on. B, your 50% of your spending is probably tied very intimately to that. And C, places like California have a huge dependency on capital gains for their budgets and things like that. So there's a number of nested reasons why you want to just keep driving Wall Street up. But remember, Plutarch said, the oldest, most fatal ailment of all republics is a gap between the rich and the poor. We're just widening this gap between the few at the top and everybody else. And that creates political pressures, which I think we just saw break out in Ireland and the UK, Scotland. They finally hit their snapping point, right? They've been totally docile forever, but then they had it. And that's what happens. They suddenly were tired of the rising fuel prices, but then they suddenly realized they were tired of all kinds of other things too, all at once. You know, that's how it works.
Yeah. And it seems to be that we're reaching that point. Now, I want to show another example of how the consumer's feeling, and I want to answer one of the, you know, common arguments about the University of Michigan sentiment survey. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a political survey. It's the other side of the political spectrum. So this has more to do with them not liking Trump or whatever. You know, there's a lot of people that can agree with that right now.
Yep.
But let me show you this one. So Liz Ann Saunders put this out today.
But that is a good point. Every survey has wrinkles, and sometimes you have to know what those wrinkles are. It makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Yeah. And it does, and that's an argument. But Liz Ann Saunders posts this, a share of consumers saying their financial situation is worse compared to a year ago due to higher prices, jumped to 54% in April versus 47% in March. Now the highest on record. Okay.
Yep.
So this is consumers saying their financial situation is worse. Now, it was already, we've been elevated here for several years at the peak of kind of the 2008 crisis and the big inflation of the, you know, late 1970s. So this is just another piece of evidence. This is an all-time high. Okay.
Wow.
Like you hear people saying, you know, in the 80s, I had, you know, 20% or 17% mortgage, and we know the damage and how severe that was and the political outcome in the 1970s inflation. But we're being told inflation is okay. You know, the market's great. The economy's great. But this is the largest share. I mean, 54%. I mean, that's a new record that we're setting while the market's going to new all-time highs. So, yeah, Wall Street's benefiting at the expense of everybody else at this point.
Yep. Well, If we look at this, I mean, that it all tracks, right? Whether this is a slightly biased sample or not, I can tell you anecdotally, I know people are really nervous. they feel a lot of anxiety. Nobody quite knows where we're going. But there's this huge disconnect between what we're being told and what people are experiencing. So we're going to have to talk about how we sort of square that circle a bit. To me, Paul, it's no more challenging than this. Regular gasoline in red on the bottom, diesel fuel in green on the top. These are some of the largest percentage spikes in the entire data series that could happen, and that's basically month over month, right? So these are extraordinary spikes. I've put out a whole argument for why I think they're going to continue to go up, and we can get into that a little bit. But the summary was the United States is exporting a lot of oil right now, oil products, hydrocarbons. You know, we're exporting a lot of stuff, but we're not actually producing anymore. So that's coming out of our inventory. So we'll look at that data in a second. But this right here, this is a huge, huge inflationary, discretionary spending hit for that 54% of the country you were just talking about. I've been shocked, right? Because I have a bunch of farm equipment. So I have this 58-gallon diesel caddy that I take to the station, fill up. Once upon a time, that was 150 to fill up. And the last time I went, it was 272.
Well, I drive a diesel truck, so I had to fill it up yesterday. And I literally never pay attention. I mean, it is what it is. I have to get in there. Prices have been pretty low. But, I mean, I have actually been paying attention when I look at it. But I was absolutely shocked. And I drove to three different stations to find the lowest cost station at the time. And, you know, and there's 30 cent spreads from one gas station to another. So it's actually shocking. And that's a gut punch to people who are already struggling right now. I mean, we've talked about this in the past several times. How many people are buying groceries on buy now, pay later, right? This was several years ago. 70% of the population didn't have enough in savings to cover expenses for 3 months. And, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, this is just demoralization on top of people who are already struggling. But you've got, you know, the wealthier part of the asset class has no concern right now. And those who either don't want to seek the truth, don't have the courage to seek the truth, or just don't want to study, right? They're caught up in their section of society, and, hey, they look at the market, their accounts are doing good, so they're completely unaware of what's taking place right now.
Yeah, I think that's pretty common, but more and more people are starting to wake up. It's almost, well, I would say more people are waking up, but it's kind of like people are separating into two camps. Those who want to know, even if the news isn't awesome, they still just need to know because they have to make plans, they got to figure stuff out, they're going to take actions, do things, right? And then there are other people who seem to not want to know. I would be strongly suggestive of the idea that the people who do want to know are the followers of this channel. Because, you know, we bring the data and we want to talk about what is, not what we wish it was or wasn't. So this is just the situation. This is a shock, though. So remember, we've talked, Paul, a lot about how it's not always the destination, but it's the pace at which you get there, right? So if we'd gone from 360 to 560 on diesel, which is what we did in 2 months here in Western Mass. If we did that over 2 years, we'd all adjust and we'd sort of work around that and it would sort of fit in. But when it hits like that, I have a logging, part of my property is being logged. This guy has to put in something ridiculous, like 300-400 gallons of diesel. He's got this giant skid operator, right? So diesel input is a huge cost input. So he had to talk to me the other day and say, I don't know we might have to put this on hold for a while because the price for the logs has stayed constant, but his input cost just spiked. Same thing for farmers, fertilizer, diesel, almost a double, and corn and wheat are right where they were. So there's going to be, it's that shock of that. You just have to see how people respond to that. But what usually happens is they say, I'm not going to plant my field this year. It doesn't make sense. I'm not going to cut the trees this year. It doesn't make sense. I'm not going to drive, to these Taekwondo lessons that are 30 minutes away. Sorry, Bobby, it just doesn't make sense. Those are all the decisions that come out of a chart like this. You can't predict them all, but the message here is that's a shock, and the shock always has impacts. It just always does.
Well, and that let's talk about it like body blows, right? So prior to this shock, you've had that individual's probably had a shock an increase in insurance costs and insurance coverage and workers' compensation insurance. All of that has been rippling through, and, you know, individuals have been able to absorb it a little bit. But those are conversations that I'm hearing with a lot of business owners, sole proprietors, even individuals are just mind blown about how expensive their property and casualty insurance, their car insurance when their kids turn 16. You know, business owners that are like, you know, my commercial insurance is ridiculous. So these are just continuing to be little dominoes that are wearing on the ability for people to continue to spend like there's no tomorrow.
Well, yes, and as you and I discussed, there's the insurance is really kind of ruinous, right? Healthcare, auto, home, and commercial. And you and I found out recently that part of the reason for that is that those industries, those insurers, are up to their eyebrows in private credit and private equity, and that there's some major losses lurking there. But good news, just today the Treasury came out, Paul, and said there's no systemic crisis in private credit today, which means it's official. It's now been denied. There's a problem.
Yeah, what was it? Was it Ben Bernanke came out and said there's nothing to worry about with some subprime? But at the same time, I'm sure you've heard the news because there's rarely anything that you miss. Is Wall Street has put collateral? Default swaps. Collateralized default swaps for you, the ability to protect yourself and get some insurance for big institutions against private credit. Mm. So there's obviously enough concern in that area to bring to market a product, which is the same thing they did about mortgages back in 2008, to protect those who know against the likely calamity that's in process right now.
You know what they say, history doesn't repeat. Yeah, sometimes it does.
Yeah, but it sure does rhyme a lot.
I know, but it's going to repeat with the credit default swap paper, I guess. All right, so, yeah, so I was saying, I put a provocative headline. I said, Will head higher. That's very sort of declarative, you know, because who can ever predict markets? But part of the argument I've been making, Paul, is that with oil, it's very complicated, but another way, it's very simple, right? So oil comes out of the ground. It gets held in inventory for a little while, and then that gets burned, right? So you have a flow of oil, you have a stock of oil, and that's a balance sheet, right? So when you're watching how a company's doing, you want to watch how the asset side of the balance sheet is doing. That's inventories, right? So we had some data come out recently, which was, oh, oil inventories are actually being exported because total commercial petroleum stocks fell by 9 million barrels last week. This data just came out this morning here on 4/15. Happy tax day. Rory Johnston does a great job tracking all this. And as you can see, well, crude was down by just a tiny bit, but gasoline, we exported a bunch of that lot. That's a big, big hit. And diesel. So we're exporting a lot of our products. So if you export a lot of diesel, where'd it come from? Well, it came from inventories. Oh, our inventories are going down. Therefore, our prices are going to go up in this country. It's just a seesaw. Inventories down and up, prices, you know? So, second part of this. Patrick DeHaan, the Gas Buddy guy, is reporting that exports have reached a new record. So that confirms what we were just suspecting. The reason that our inventories went down is, well, we're exporting a ton. 89 million barrels exported in the last week, which, that's enormous. 7 into 89 gives me 119, 2, let's call it somewhere between 12 million barrels per day. That's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. And we threw out a bunch of oil and a whole bunch of this gasoline, distillates, and jet fuel. Wow. Wow. And here you go. Yeah, that would be about 12.7 million barrels right there. And Zero Hedge said, America has never exported more oil. And I had to correct that because it's not actually oil. It's actually hydrocarbon products. So we're still a net importer of crude oil. Maybe not this one week. We might have thrown so much out the door from inventories. It's possible we were net. But this is actually oil products. This is oil products. So that includes the distillates we talked about, diesel, jet fuel, gasoline. But it also includes things like the natural gas liquids, which is propane, ethane, butane. We're swimming in that stuff. But here's the point, Paul. The production flows didn't change that week. So it wasn't like we suddenly started producing a lot more. To the extent we exported more than ever, it came out of our inventories, which means our prices are going to go higher. So most likely explanation is that oil is a global market and there's bidders out there. And somebody in Europe said, hey, I'll pay you this much for diesel. And inside the country, our internal bidders are like, well, we'll only pay you that much. And guess what? The higher bidder won. This is how the U.S. is directly exposed to global oil markets. It doesn't matter how much we produce here. It matters how much somebody else is willing to pay for it. That's the defining factor.
Right. And as those inventories get drawn down, then the price here is going to have to expand dramatically to keep it here. And then, you know, and then if there's an escalation up because there are shortages, then the question is how high can it go and who has the deepest pockets to be able to buy it?
Yeah. So, listen, as long as I see our inventories getting raided like that, I'm positive that prices are going higher in the future. Because, remember, Paul, I don't have the chart with me, but we've put up the PQ chart, which says price and supply and demand all sort of settle out in some magic spot, right? And the only way, if you don't have enough supply, the price has to rise to make the demand fall enough so that that magic dot works out again. If you hold prices down, so some countries tried to do this for a while. I think Thailand tried it for a little while. Europe tried it for a while. Like, oh, we'll just keep the prices down. So they subsidized, they lowered taxes. But that just kept the price down so demand could stay where it was. And the problem was you can't cure that way. The only cure for a supply shortfall is for demand to be destroyed. And the only way you do that with market forces is let the price rise until somebody like me says, I'm not going to take that drive to the store today. I'd rather save that gas, you know?
Well, and two, if the market is able to function, if there's not the hidden hand that's pushing it, it's like, you know, you're driving 75 miles an hour down the road. You see congestion coming and you're able to slow that car down. You know, and you talk about it's not the price rate, it's the rate of change, right? Jump off the building and hit the ground slowly. You know, my concern is here you're driving 75 miles an hour. There is no signal to warn you. And if we don't get that supply destruction corrected because price is manipulated, it's all of a sudden a catastrophic crash. Like you hit an invisible wall that you didn't see coming because the market wasn't able to actively warn you in that price discovery.
Well, that's exactly right. We need for there to be as much adjustment as possible, which is why I am such a staunch free market advocate when it comes to oil, because it's you can't print it, right? It's like, you know, 2008, you know, our credit default swaps and CDOs and all this other stuff blew up. Those are all human constructs, papered over, fine. This is different, right? You can't fix what's about to happen with that oil shock by printing more money or handing out more money to subsidize so they can consume more oil. It doesn't work. We're going to have to get demand in line with supply. And the only way to do that that's fair is you allow prices to rise, okay, so that the demand is destroyed that way. The other way, remember, I don't really remember this, but I was alive during the period. I must have been too young, just sitting in the back seat. But, you know, in the 70s, they did rationing, right? Even-numbered plates, odd-numbered plates, you can only buy X number of gallons and, you know, all that. And that, so rationing is what happens when you run out of supply and you haven't figured out how to get your demand down there. You force it. If you don't want to get into the forcing function, which is chaotic, I don't think we should ever go there again. Doesn't work, really, long-term, is you have to allow prices to rise. It's very simple. And we have not allowed prices to adjust here in the United States. There is a very obvious visible hand, Scott Bissett, because they talked about maybe they should intervene in the futures market. Next thing you know, the futures market for oil is not behaving at all like people expect or remember. So there's a visible hand. They're trying to hold it down. Maybe you could make the argument, look, it's only going to last a while. We're positive about that. So we're just going to hold oil down for now. And then later we'll sort of let the steam out slowly, right? But what if that's not the case? What if this war goes on longer and all of a sudden that beach ball they've been holding down has to erupt? Then you get another price shock. Like oil goes from allegedly $92 a barrel WTI on the front month contract as of now, and it suddenly has to vault to 150 or some other number, like fast. that's the kind of shock that, again, Paul, leads to massive changes in behavior, unpredictable changes in behavior. Very difficult to control what happens next, because you can't. It's individual decisions that people make, businesses make, about how they're going to respond to that.
Well, and my concern would be rationing in the 1970s is going to be completely different economic impact than rationing today. Because one thing that I believe shocked a lot of people is how just in time our inventory was that we discovered in COVID, right? That just in time inventory is max profitability for corporations, because you're not got a bunch of dead weight sitting there in inventory. But it was a completely different environment back in the 1970s, because people had more inventory that they had on hand as a savings for those businesses, based on the research that I've done. So because of the nature of that just-in-time inventory, right, that rationing, I would assume, would have a greater impact on the economy now than what it did in the 1970s.
But here's the thing. It's all very unpredictable, because our economy is a complex system. You can't factor in how people are going to make decisions, right? Because you're complex, I'm complex, your situation's different, mine's different from everybody else's. So it's kind of hard to figure out how that's going to ripple through. But I think we're getting to something really important here, which is that prices need to reflect reality, which means intervention, by definition, gives you an artificial price. And maybe that's happening, maybe it's not, but certainly we're getting fairly artificial pricing, because as of right now, even though it's $92 for WTI, on the open market, those people bidding for all those inventories that just went away, the diesel, the gasoline, those are trading outside our borders on the open ocean in the Atlantic as if it's $148 a barrel right now. And that gap has never been wider. 92 next month. Today, 142. That's what's driving a lot of that rapid exporting going on, because people are like, you're selling it for 92? And whoosh, they're going to just pull those tankers right up and grab that immediately, right? And I don't think they're paying 92 at the port. They're paying a lot more than that. But it hasn't caught all the way up. We've never seen a gap like that open up. How do you get stocks rebounding to all-time highs and this huge gap in oil during the most punishing, amazing energy shock and related derivative shocks in world history? This is the largest energy shock the world has ever experienced on a percentage basis ever. That's for crude oil and for natural gas. Nothing like it in world history. But sulfur, urea, ammonia, helium, aluminum. It's amazing how many other things are shocking right now. We've never experienced any shocks in each one of those areas I just mentioned either. So against that backdrop, you're like, let's buy stocks. You know,
it doesn't make sense unless you're just a completely passive machine, or fully convinced that passive is the way to go. Mm-hmm. Right. But even in that passive environment, you shouldn't see this type of flow. I mean, you really shouldn't, because of the fact most of your money flow is going to come in on the first week of the month, right? 401ks withhold from the paychecks. They put that back in. There can be some on the 15th. The largest amount comes in, you know, is paid in once every 30 days. So I can get it if we're in the first week. And then another stat that I saw today is April the 15th, which is today, tax day, is historically the, you know, a negative day for the markets because of the drain of liquidity, making payments and moving out. But we happen to hit all-time highs today, right? So that isn't even following the historical pattern.
Well, we're going to track one more thing as we come into the next segment here. And it's about how the producer price index reading came in. And Paul, I had to squint at it pretty long and hard. We'll talk about that just as soon as we come back. Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. Welcome back, everybody. Paul, you heard this, I'm sure. Let's talk about it for everybody's benefit. Maria Bartiromo talking about the March Producer Price Index. So March was during the, you know, this period where we had all of the war going on and all sorts of crazy price shocks. And she's crowing here saying that PPI, the Producer Price Index reading, came in much better than expected. It was pretty exciting. So the core PPI was only 3.8%. And they expected 4.2. So let's put this in context real quick. First, this is how it looks on a long-term chart. The PPI here, much better than expected, exclamation point, Paul. I mean, it was a little steeper here from in the 2021, 2020, coming into 2022. But I don't see a big exciting change in trend there, do you?
No. And literally, based on the large majority of history outside of that one window, it still looks to be accelerating, right? I mean, maybe it comes in better than expected, but that is a curve that looks to be accelerating higher.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's not, I don't consider that, that's better than the 4.2 that they set the expectation for. But that's still not a good number.
So, look, we've been talking about this for a long time that, you know, when we're discussing jobs numbers, which I call the McJobs numbers, there's been a strong propensity to fudge those numbers, and they were fudged under Biden, meaning that they would always report a better jobs number, and then quietly a month or two later it'd be revised down, and they report a great number to get revised down, and under Trump that continued. And so we find that out of the last, I think, 22 months, like 20 of them have been revised down, right? So we've just all learned that that's sort of that's a fudged number, always biased to make things look better than they are. I think that the same thing is happening with the producer price index. And here's my data for that. So here are the subcomponents of that PPI, right? And then they break it all down for you. And it's got final demand goods. And I chopped off the other part, which would be on this side, which is final demand for services. But let's just look at goods. They said the total was 1.6% for the month. Like, okay, let's annualize that. 1.6 times 12. It's like plus a little because you have to compound it. That's a big number. That's high double-digit inflation and final demand for goods, right? But they said, oh, don't worry about it. Food is actually down 0.3% on the month. Weird. But energy was up 8.5%, they said, in March. Energy's up 8.5%. Can we take a quick peek at what energy actually went up since the start of the war? Jet fuel up 66%, diesel plus 50%, WTI crude 37%, gasoline 32%. Okay.
Golly.
How did we get 8.5% out of those numbers? And I know electricity is missing, and electricity certainly didn't spike all that much, but these are about two-thirds of the energy cost. So how did that happen? It's just another one of those mysteries.
I didn't see any negative 60s in there to offset that higher number.
No. So anyway, but gosh, look at that. Since the start of the war.
Wow.
That's big. That for 2 months, for a two-month hike, coal 14% over those 2 months. You know, European natural gas, 34%. Sulfur, 67%. This is all going to start to feed through eventually. They're going to have to play catch-up on these numbers, and these will be revised upwards, almost guaranteed that. But the mystery, here's the mystery of the markets. How does this happen, Paul? So there are certain bonds out there that track the inflation rate or the expected rate of inflation. So the bond market's inflation outlook was parked along here through most of March at about 5.25%, and in a single tick, in a single 2 days reading, collapsed all the way back to 3.5%. How does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, there's technical ways that that could happen, but that doesn't make sense to me at all. Wow.
And it's not a bad tick. It's one, two, it's 3 days. 3 days I can see on there. The bend.
Yeah.
Three little legs on that thing. Crazy.
Wow.
And how does that square up with the stocks saying maybe there's going to be more printing, potentially, if that's what they're saying?
Yeah.
Stocks are either saying there's more printing or the economy is a lot better than people expect, in which case inflation is going to be higher because we have less energy at a higher price. That's the very definition of how you get an inflation expectation. I can't make sense of these markets anymore.
That's a little small for me to see. So that's a 1 year one year out inflation expectation, correct?
Yep.
And so this is the bond market, which are supposed to be the smartest traders in the room.
Yep.
You know, the only question that I would wonder is if that market's still actually looking into the future. Have they already surmised that the spike comes, there's enough economic damage that there's a massive recession down the road, and that's adjusting for those prices? That's the only thing that would make sense for me.
Then bonds and stocks are out of kilter again. In a big way.
In a big way. And if I had to trust one thing, I'd trust the bond market over the stock market. Because, look, they always say the bond market bond traders are the, well, all things being equal in an honest market, right? So the bond traders work on such thin margins, you know, they always say it's consistent theme, they're the smartest individuals in the room. So because, look, you know, your gains on the best bond that you purchase, yeah, you can buy something that's borderline default and you can make 30-40% on them. But they're looking at a couple of percentage points difference to be one of the legendary bond funds out there compared to the AGG or the Treasury, right? Whereas stocks can be 20-30% margin for error. So you can be a little bit more of a gunslinger in that area than you can be in the bond market. So, you know, I mean, that's the only hope that I would have in that chart, because that type of a move doesn't make sense outside of the fact that somebody's saying, well, we've got some deflation coming, or deflationary pressures coming, because of what reason? You know, prices spike to the point, demand destruction happens, economy really struggles and comes apart, housing finally corrects back to the level of prices that people can actually transact again. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud right here, so I may be completely off base.
Well, we have to struggle with it because it's kind of a shocking move, because you can see here that inflation expectations, even all through January and early February, were rising even before the war.
Yeah.
Right? Then you have the war itself, which sort of really juices expectations. It sort of chops along for a while, but then all of a sudden collapsed back to before the war.
Yeah.
This is a lower expectation of inflation than before the war started. And I don't have time, but I could give you recitations of transportation costs, fuel surcharges, just plastic costs going up by X cents per pound. Like, I'm watching these little things all over the place. There are lots and lots of highly inflationary readings, and those are in the pipeline, right? There's once Dow tells you that your polypropylene is going to be 50 cents more per pound to buy, it's going to be that way for a while, right? Because of the nature of that business. They don't just dial it up one week and down the next, you know. This, I can't make sense of this chart right now. So maybe it's, I have to look into it. Maybe it's a bad tick, a couple of bad readings. It'll be right back up there. I don't know, because otherwise it's a very bizarre thing.
It's a very bizarre, and it's highly unlikely somebody got forced out of a position there that could impact the market that quick in that environment. I'd love to know the percentile move in that. Is that 100th percentile going back? I mean, you just don't see moves like that within the past year, but I'd love to know if that's the largest single several-day move or weekly move over the past 30 or 40 years, you know, just to have some context in that. I mean, it's rare that you see moves like that. I don't know that I've ever seen a move like that in that environment.
Or this is, again, one of those invisible hand moments. So it's possible.
Yeah, it is certainly possible.
Yeah. I don't know. But so everything rests right now. A lot of things rest on whether or not the Strait of Hormuz gets opened back up again. And let's take a quick look at this, because just this morning, Trump announced that he is permanently opening the Strait of Hormuz. Unclear what that means. Normally, that would be a market-moving sort of an announcement. Everything kind of yawned. But can we just look at this real quick? So February 26, before the war, 132 vessels crossed through the strait going both ways. February 27th, 128. February 28th, 98, because it was on that evening, deep in the evening of the February 28th, that the strikes happened. March 1st, 7, 18, then 7, then 2, then 2, then 1. March 6th, 0. March 12th, 0. March 15th, 0. Just bouncing along near 0. March 21st, 2, then 3. But again, not 132, 128. Big excitement here around March 28th. We had 12 vessels cross, most of them Chinese flagged, coming on back through. But here we are on April 12th, 14 vessels. So you can see it's opened up a little bit, but most of these are ones that Iran has allowed to go through. So for Trump to say, hey, we're permanently opening the Strait of Hormuz, something's going to have to really fundamentally be different than currently is happening. How does he do that? I've been listening to all kinds of people. The only way he can do that is either we make peace with Iran, which means we're going to have to give up on some terms. So it's an actual negotiation. We don't just dictate the terms to them. We get some conciliatory, you win some things, we win some things, you lose some things, we lose some things. That's negotiations. But either we get it through negotiations or we're going to have to escalate the war.
Well, and here's the question I'll ask. Let's say, best case scenario, it's fully open. Everything's ready to go. Chris, how long is it going to take to get back to 133 full vessels again because of all the infrastructure destruction that's taken place? You know, so how long is it going to take to get back there?
Months. And in some cases, years, right? Because the LNG trains that got blown up on the Qatar side, they think they're getting this very expensive components that they have 2 to 5 years, they said, they're going to have to rebuild that. It'll take months to just sort of bollocks the container ships. Like, they're all the ships are in the wrong spot of the world right now. What you need is this really beautiful free-flowing Congo line, ships coming in, ships going out, everything's passing. You have the right number of bulk carriers, crude carriers, product carriers, etc., LNG ships. They all have to be in the right place at the right time. It's highly synchronized. It's like fully choreographed, you know. That choreography will take months to come back. And so, yeah, we have this really bad hole from all those red dots on there, and even those yellowish, orangish dots are really bad hole. That hole is going to take a long time to fill all on its own, because that represents oil that didn't happen and other things that didn't happen. In the case of aluminum, it's going to take a year probably to get that back up and running again. So again, I think maybe, Paul, it's so complicated. The market just doesn't know how to digest it properly, or something's off here, because this is the biggest economic shock the world has ever faced. And we just don't I think the honest answer is we don't know how this is going to play out yet.
And my biggest concern is with passive, what was it I heard Michael Green stated, if I remember correctly, somewhere between 63 and 68% of all dollars are completely passive. They're not even, you know, passive means you do not take any information into consideration, right? And you're going to be passive if it's just simply the passive money flows coming in that are price insensitive. You know, there is no preparation. There is no attempt to adapt outside of those smaller sectors of the market like us that are running tactical risk managed portfolios that are preparing for this, that are getting defensive until the information changes, right? So that means it's going to party right up to the point that it hits that invisible wall, and then the damage on the other side is probably going to, you know, scar a generation when they needed their money at the most, right, to get them through retirement and the rest of their life that God gives them. It's going to dramatically change. That passive is going to cause a lot of problems for a lot of people. If it's just as simple as that.
I found this chart that showed, you know, back in the late 90s, how much of the market action was what you call active versus passive investing. And it was basically 80-20. And it's almost exactly reverse now. So that 80% is passive, what are called passive strategies. And so that's a big shift. So you're right. So those flows are just coming in all the time, just irregardless, as they say, of what's happening in the world.
And that's unfortunate. I mean, it has its place in the market, but that is ridiculously unfortunate because everything has that pendulum to where this is the ideal, most efficient area. It gets pushed to, you know, to the point where you lack efficiency and brittleness comes into the system, and then it swings back below. And we're way on that outside. I mean, you look at market valuations at all-time high. You look at just all the distortions that are in the market, and very few people. The news media is not doing a good job of educating people about that. No one on Wall Street is doing anything to really prepare people. And, you know, massive what the average person is hearing. And it's a sad situation because it's easy to see. Now, I don't know if it leads to a calamity in 6 months, 12 months, or 24 months. It's easy to see there is a calamity coming. It's impossible to determine when it gets here. What we can look at is say, hey, what's the one, you know, spear that's in the air is the oil situation, right? I mean, that could be what cuts the market's Achilles heel.
Okay, this is so hard to I'm trying to struggling how to sort of communicate this because it's just that important. But we've never seen anything like this. This is total observable inventories onshore, oil, on water, excuse me, every possible way you can. This comes from Eric Nuttall at Nine Point Partners or Nine Point Capital. So this is where we are. This is where we'll be at this first yellow star if it continues one more week. And if the war continues one more week and one more week, right? Or if the strait stays closed, irrespective of whether the war continues or not. If the strait stays closed just three more weeks, we are going to be in all-time brand new ultra-low territory. And that, Paul, is where countries start panicking a little. Right? They say, I'm going to hoard this for myself. I'm not going to export. We've already seen those export bans or controls or limits being placed by China on petroleum products. They don't want to export any of those. They're holding them back. Russia just started to do the same thing. Of course, they're seeing their refineries be attacked by Ukraine. So they have to hold it back to make sure that their domestic citizens have what they need. Out of 180 countries, about 160 of them are oil importing nations. So if the 20 exporting nations suddenly decide not to do that anymore, it is a very, very big problem. So this is the ticking clock. I think that's why we see these, you know, voluble, wild sort of gyrational statements from Trump, because he's really struggling to figure out how to put pressure on Iran to get this over with. We only have a few weeks left before we get into sort of what we'd call the panic stage. So this all needs to resolve soon.
It does.
Right? And Trump says, we're gonna open the strait. Like, okay, buddy, negotiation, which means you're going to have to lose some face, or you're going to have to escalate it to a point where you can actually get that job done. And I'll bet you anything that's not as easy as they think it is.
And what concerns me about that, now, this may not be the best analogy. There is potentially in there, if I can formulate it correctly. But when I studied the German hyperinflation and what happened during that period of time, there were store owners that literally shut their doors and quit selling the inventory because the inventory was increasing faster than they could take the money in, purchase a replacement for that inventory, and come back. So that further exacerbated the hyperinflationary situation. So what happens, because we have to have that energy to continue. So if this continues at that path and that gets down to that level, what's going to happen? Those 20 countries that are net exporters, if they can, you know, cover their own, and then, you know, exporters in general, not net. I don't want to get into that technicality, but they're just going to go to the highest bidder. I mean, it's just human nature. They're going to go to the highest bidder, and as long as you have money to pay us, we're going to do that. And as soon as you run out of money, we're going to move to the next person. And that's just economic catastrophe for those countries that have to have that. What? You've explained it. Oil and energy is the lifeblood of our economy. We have to transport things. We have to get there. And we're not in a situation where the average person can rely on their own garden at this point. We just can't.
Well, and to be clear, closing the Strait of Hormuz really impacts Asia a lot more than than it does the West. Okay.
Right.
And because of that, we saw this happen where Bloomberg reports that Asia's LNG demand falls to six-year lows. Like, no, no, the demand didn't fall. The supplies fell. So it's a weird way to phrase that. They're like, oh, look, their demand fell. No, no, no. Their supplies fell. They went from 800, you know, 1,000 tons down to 575,000 tons. That decline right there happened because the Qatari LNG plants got shut down and LNG was not leaving the Gulf. So that's not... That's supply destruction leading to demand destruction. That's what that is right there. And I think it bears noting that just yesterday, President Xi of China came out and said, quote, the Western-led world order is crumbling into disarray. So
yeah,
they're taking it pretty seriously, and they know who's responsible for making that happen at this point in time. So I'm just hoping that we have cooler heads because, you know, if we decide to enforce that export ban on, you know, or the transiting of the strait on Chinese ships, China's already said don't do that. If this goes into the China phase of this whole thing, Paul, all bets are off as to what happens next.
Yeah. And you know what concerns me is any tense situation, it's the quiet, most calm person in the room that you really need to pay attention to because they're the one that typically carries the biggest stick. It's mm-hmm. not the person that's bloviating and yelling the loudest that you need to be the most concerned about. And they've been very calm and calculated in their statements and responses to what's been going on, especially in consideration of the impact that it has delivered upon them.
Well, we're just going to have to see how this all tracks out, but... Again, I don't think the markets are even remotely pricing in or reflecting what I think is the true nature and severity of the scale of this particular crisis. And as it's a poly crisis. Yes, it's oil. It's also natural gas. And it's also all these other elements and precursors and every downstream product that happens from that. And so that's just something we're all going to have to track on that. I've been taking this very seriously personally. And I know other people think, be a temporary blip. They could be right.
Yeah.
But I'm treating this, Paul, as if it's the real deal. This is it. This is a giant energy shock in a world, let's be clear about this, in the West particularly is awash in debt and derivatives. We have a lot of carefully architected, but a little bit rickety financial sort of things that keep the whole thing stitched together. And we've talked about that in the construct of the Great Taking or how markets actually function. And the whole thing either kind of works really well or it doesn't. It doesn't really have an in-between state, you know? And I think they're doing everything they can to keep it functioning and no fault about that. But what's our plan, right? Are we willing to concede anything in this war so that we can pull this back before it goes over some sort of chaotic brink? That would be my vote if I had one.
Yeah. Well, you know, just a couple of things that come to mind. One, unfortunately for somebody I have a friend that his ministry in his life is bringing people out of addiction, and he's got a prison ministry. It's phenomenal what God's allowed him to do in the lives of individuals. Mm-hmm. And we had a mutual friend and he was kind of helping me through. I was disappointed this individual wasn't able to get out of their situation. And he said, Paul, when the pain of changing is easier than taking the same path, somebody will change. And that's my concern, is we're going to get this major pain at some point that's going to dramatically change the global order. And the rest of the world will be tired of, you know, kind of our imperialism and being bullied to where all of a sudden it's like, hey, I can't take this pain anymore. This global order is falling apart anyway. We are going to act. And that concerns me. Now, mm-hmm. you know, and looking at this, the second thing that I wanted to say is what you're doing is you're helping people be prudent. Okay. You're looking out there, your information scout, you're laying this information out. When it goes back to the Great Taking, you know, and I shared this because I believe it's so important now. And the book of Proverbs, I love because it's life application of wisdom. Of, you know, God, how God expects us to live. And twice it tells us the prudent foresee danger and hide themselves. Now, first I want to say is people don't need to embrace fear, right? But at the same time, we feel fear if you look at this. And the definition of courage, my definition of courage that I heard somewhere, is feeling the fear but making the right decisions anyway. Or, you know, continuing through with the right action in spite of the fear. Courage doesn't mean that we eliminate fear. It means that you feel it and you make the most prudent and wise decision to begin with. You don't speculate on the outcome. So how do we do that in the great taking, right? We can't hide ourselves. Prudent foresee danger and hide themselves, because you can't escape it completely. But what you can do is shelter yourself by getting out of type two accounts, staying in type one, you know, maximizing your SIPC coverage as best you can, making sure that you're not over the FDIC limits. Now, is that guaranteed? No, it's not. But you can be prudent and still operate within that system. So when it comes to investing, I can't tell people what to do. And I want them to understand, when you are prudent and you have an active strategy, a tactical strategy that can mitigate risk, is it going to be perfect? Absolutely not. Because if it was perfect, everybody would do it. And then when everybody's doing it, it's not going to work anymore, right? You know, when the whole market's doing the exact same thing, you know, there has to be a counterbalance. So from our standpoint, right, and you know, work your strategy, make decisions, and some of the best investments that I've ever made in our strategies and some of the best sales that I've ever made was terrified of being wrong. And I told clients a couple of times, you know, especially back in 2012, we got a long-term sell signal on gold. I don't know that I can say that, because I'm supposed to counterbalance it out with a bad decision, but this, you know, I'll just go down this path. So when we got that long-term sell signal, I told a client, I said, I'm going to go off my back porch at the office. Sorry for the graphicness of this. I'm going to throw up. I'm going to feel the fear, and I'm going to do it anyway. We're going to, you know, take our profits and sit on the sideline. Because you didn't know. I mean, even at that time, there was such euphoria around gold and silver that I could have opened 150 accounts if I'd have been willing to tell people I think it's a great investment at this moment in time. I still like it from a long-term standpoint at the time, but in a different avenue. So, right, you've got to have a plan. And Chris, you've done such a good job of helping people be prudent. So, you know, we can see that there's risks coming. At least shelter and hide yourself, okay? If you choose to be passive, that's fine. Build up your emergency fund. Oh, this is something I had two people ask me about. Emergency fund, okay? Let me clarify that a little bit more for a couple people that asked. Good question. When I say emergency fund, I want that in an FDIC, you know, highest paying protected money market account, or treasuries, or treasury money market, depending upon how much it is, because as a U.S. investor, treasuries are the safest thing that you can own technically, because FDIC is a government agency that could theoretically not be held up, but treasuries are a direct obligation of the U.S. government. Yeah, long term, there's all kinds of things to worry about, but where we are right now, that's the safest thing that you can own. I don't want somebody to have 24 months of cash sitting in a safe at the house, because one, you can earn 3.5, 3.6% in some of the safest yielding assets, or maybe it's 3.3 right now, somewhere in that neighborhood. And at least that's helping you keep up with the cost of living, right? Maybe it's not keeping up with exactly what's taking place, but that's better than having all that cash sitting in the bank. Now, if somebody wants to have cash, from my argument, keep 2 or 3 months worth of your food expenses, because if you had a banking shutdown, if you have cash to go buy food and a few things like that for a couple of months, you've got cash on hand. I don't count that as a catastrophe fund, right? So have a catastrophe fund, but 2 or 3 months, not necessarily, because if you have a mortgage and the banking system shut down, you're not going to be able to send that money to cover that mortgage. You'll have to work that out after it's over with. But the emergency fund, if you're going to be in a passive strategy, have 24 months, right? For the clients that I have in a actively risk managed strategy, I'm fine with 12 months, because we're going to make some moves to protect on this side those assets. The reason why it's so important to have 24 months is, if you're going to be passive, what happens if we have a market calamity? Okay, history tells us, from where we are right now, what's the worst historical outcome from how expensive this market is right now? That's a 70% decline from where we are right now, assuming the earnings hold up. The Great Depression tells us it could be an 80 to 90% decline. Okay, so if we do have this calamity that that could potentially unfold, that you could clearly see unfolding, that the market's ignoring, and you want to stay passive, that's fine. But don't be in a position to where you are forced to sell at the worst time. Because if you're fully invested all the time and the market goes down and you need money and it's down 70%, you're forced to sell. You're not in a position to where you can allow those to come back to normal. Because if we have a calamity, what's going to happen is if we do go down 70%, that fear is going to push us below where we should go. And that's usually the point where people panic or are forced out. And it's the worst thing that you could do to your financial situation from a long-term standpoint. Mm-hmm. Now, for me, I'm running a risk-managed strategy, but I tend to keep 24 months of my expenses set aside because 12 is my emergency and 12 is my crazy opportunity money, right? And I'm okay if I don't make great returns on that because that's the strategy that I have seriously considered. I've thought through and weighed the opportunity versus the risks. So, you know, look, at this right now, don't feel the fear. Develop a strategy. If you don't have somebody that has a strategy, yeah, you're going to feel it, but have the courage to make the prudent decisions anyway. Because in the big scheme of things, for most people that I meet, and that's why it's so important to go through that retirement planning analysis that I go with people, is I want to demonstrate for them, look, you're in a position to where what can hurt you the most? Is it missing a little bit of opportunity? Is it you doing 8% because you were prudent and cautious versus 10 or 11% that's going to wipe you out? Absolutely not. It's going to hurt your feelings. And if you've got a prick for a brother-in-law, I don't. Just to be clear, I've had people ask me about that. I have two great brother-in-laws. But you got a prick for a brother-in-law that's bragging all the time in your ear. Yeah, it's going to hurt your feelings. You might feel a little bit stupid. But it's not 8% versus 11% or 5% versus 7% for 90% of the people that are out there that have saved enough that's going to wipe them out. It's a 50, 60, 70% decline that you have 25 years before you get back to even. It happened to us during the Great Depression. It happened to the Japanese Nikkei Index in the late 1980s. That's what can dramatically upend your retirement. Now, should you go throw everything in treasuries and be completely on the other side? I don't know, right? That's what that retirement analysis is able to show people at 3.5%, 5.5% or higher inflation. Can you do that? If that's what you want to do and you're okay with the outcome, that's fine. But I've seen too many people that let fear drive them completely out or greed drive them completely in. And you need to be balanced and adaptive in there from our perspective, because working with retirees for 28 years and going through the 2000, 2003 and the 2008, you know, yeah, there are people that were way too scared. They didn't have a strategy. They just buried it in the bank. Inflation's eating them alive and they didn't see it coming. But on the other hand, there were a lot more people that were too aggressive, too greedy. They didn't know it. You know, they're just doing what they were told to do or doing what everybody else was doing. That the 2000 to 2003 was a major body blow, right? I mean, they got punched in a boxing analogy and they were stumbling. And 2008 was worse than a knockout punch. It snapped their neck and completely upended their lifestyle. And I just don't want to see that happen. The most recent past has had that occur already.
Thank you for that. That's brilliantly said. I want to add one more thing to that, though, because this isn't just what's the market going to do. You and I have been talking about this, Paul. I've been hearing more and more and more about people who are losing their jobs to AI, formerly very well-paid people, typically in the IT space, but you can see it's starting to spread. So having a buffer is going to be really important. I know there's a lot of people out there. I was just, you know, heard about this guy, 28 years as an IT professional, secure, top of his game, knew what was going on. Out of a job, no jobs to be had, right? So that's going to be coming along too. So there is still that AI juggernaut breathing down on a lot of the so-called cognitive jobs out there. But this it hasn't quite hit yet, but it will. Lawyers, doctors, paralegals, CPAs. I mean, you can just feel it coming, right? And so that's another reason to begin to build up that buffer. A lot of reasons to have a good buffer these days.
It is. And at the same time, you know, I hear there are, and this is true, right? If you're in the trades, you're sheltered from AI and whatever happens. Yeah, AI may not be able to go do the plumbing on a house right now, but if it wipes out all of the jobs of individuals that are educated, they do have a skill set, they're, you know, if if everybody, the only job that's out there is plumbers and electricians, well, you're going to have a whole lot more competition with individuals that have to get in there. So it's not just one sector. One sector has been great and may continue to be great, but supply demand. If you can't get jobs over here, there's other people that would go in. You know, look, I'm not a trained plumber, but I can go learn that, right? I could go work for somebody and learn that. More individuals doing that same thing brings down that income in that area. So it's going to be hard. There's not really going to be anywhere, if the worst case scenario AI comes about, that somebody's going to hide, right? Everybody's going to be learning to repair their own stuff because nobody's going to have the money to be able to pay somebody else to do it, if that's the case. So, and then one last thing, and I want to do, since I'm on a rant right here, bear with me, guys. I had a conversation with somebody the other day that's in the high technology space that's getting impacted by AI. Okay. They had a 2.5% mortgage. They're in a good financial position. You know, we've argued the difference. Hey, you've got some arbitrage here. You've got some treasuries. They wanted to maximize that 2.5. And my argument to them is look, your colleagues have had a hard time finding work. You're having a hard time finding work. You've got the money without putting yourself in a bad financial position to sweep some profits off and do away with that mortgage, right? That lowers your cost of living dramatically. It keeps you from being in a position to where you're forced to sell that house or you lose that house in the future. You know, big deal if your house goes from $1 million to $500,000, that hurts your feelings. But if your house goes from $1 million to $500,000 and you owe $500,000 on it, 2%, you're forced to sell it, well, where are you going to go? And especially if you can't get the income to go get another mortgage to buy something else, right? And if the market has gone down dramatically enough to where, you know, your resources are drained or you're forced to sell. So I've always recommended that people pay their homes off if they can do it without putting themselves, you know, in a bad financial decisions, right? You don't want to just cash out a 401k all at once and pay off a house. You have to do it structured. I've never had anybody that has regretted paying off their house when they did it in the right way. Okay. Never have I had anybody do that. All the comments that I've had over the past 28 years is, wow, I didn't realize that subconscious pressure that I was feeling. And what I've found is every one of those clients are better investors, because now all of a sudden, if the market drops 10 or 15% in a normal pullback correction, they're not imagining, what if I lose my house in retirement? They're better investors. You may be missing that arbitrage between 2.5%, 3% versus 4.5%, right? You might be missing that, but the peace of mind that you have allows them to be better investors to where they actually make a little bit more over the longer term because they can handle shorter term volatility. Now, if we all knew that we're going to have a hyperinflationary holocaust, then absolutely you're better off to keep that mortgage. But we don't know that, right? Because if AI takes away that many jobs, that's deflationary. Okay, so even if our currency collapses, you still got some deflation. So I, you know, just one thing that I haven't really stated before while we're on this track of being prudent and protecting yourself, if you can do it in a tax efficient way, you know, consider, talk to a professional. I don't know every individual situation, but the peace of mind that you have from a house that's paid for is absolutely important. And typically it makes you a better investor from a long-term standpoint. So don't get sold by Wall Street, and don't think about the tax deduction, because here's the math, right? I hear this all the time and argue with CPAs. Well, that, you know, you get the deduction on that interest. Well, that's great. You do get a deduction on that interest. But if your interest is $10,000 and you're in a 40% tax bracket, just to make the numbers extreme, well, you're paying $4,000 less taxes than what you otherwise would, but you're paying $6,000 to your favorite banker to save $4,000 in taxes. And as much as I hate what the government's doing with our taxes, I'd rather pay $4,000 in taxes and stick $6,000 in my pocket that I can reinvest somewhere else. So, you know, there's a whole lot of incentives for the machine to convince you to do things to stick money in their own pocket. So look, you're going to have to pay taxes. We got to play the game by the rules that forced upon us. But If I can stick $6,000 in my pocket by paying $4,000 out versus saving $4,000 and paying $6,000 out, that's a decent arbitrage from a long-term standpoint. Arbitrage is probably not the right word, but I'll stick with it since that's what I said a couple of times before. Sorry.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And I probably have some more strategies I should be thinking through here myself. If anybody listening to this wants to learn how to be prudent and undertake some of the wisdom that's over there at Kiker Wealth Management, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com and fill out a very simple form. And within 48 business hours, somebody from Paul's team will be back in touch with you to set up the first of what should be 3 phone calls, an introductory call, a planning call, and then a recommendation call. And if it all works out and it makes sense, maybe all work together. But everybody should undertake the planning process, I believe, because it's free, no obligation, and it's a prudent thing to do. So with that, Paul, thank you so much for your time today, bud. And I'll see you next decade.
Yeah, I'll see you next decade. Good to see you again today, Chris.
Bye, everybody. See you next week.